I'm good to my friends.
Hey, listeners, thanks for tuning in to this week's Taking It Down. We're brought to you by the website The Alabama Take, and we're here to talk about our ideas on pop culture. Specifically this week, the HBO Max documentary Fake Famous and the Netflix film The Dig. As is our wont, we'll also talk odds and ends to begin the podcast. This week's episode is brought to you by Pfizer. Pfizer, when you want to say fuck you to Moderna. If you haven't, folks, subscribe to us on your podcast app. Give us a rating. We will begin. Joining me, as always, probably 99% of the time now at this point, it's Mr. Adam Morrow and Mr. Donovan Reinwald.
I think Adam is straight up your co-host at this point.
He was on tour.
I'm a distinguished guest.
He was on tour for a while, and we had to get some folks to chime in his stead.
And now I'm unemployed. So it all worked out in the end.
This podcasting business is making you a lot of money, though.
That's true. Between that and the GameStop, I'm sitting pretty.
Didn't you? So you haven't lost your shirt last week?
Buy high and sell low, right?
Oh, yeah, like, yeah, golf. Yeah.
You want that number to be low.
I keep hearing that you saying buy high and sell low, but in Bobby Hill's voice. Like, buy high and sell low. Now I get it, Dad.
Like the episode where they find Hank's quote-unquote oil records. And Bobby's like, we got oil. And he thinks they're rich, but it's just like, you know, about the lawnmower.
Yes.
Adam, I'll set you up here. You're talking about podcasting, making money off podcasting. The Alabama Take's got a little. Give me a short phrase, one word tease of something, and we'll elaborate more next week. But drop a tease on us.
If you have songs that you hate, perhaps you would enjoy listening to a podcast called "This Song Sucks" with some profoundly negative people talking about songs that they hate.
Comically negative.
Right. Right.
A lot more on this next week, listeners. That's your tease, though. Gentlemen, I got great news. Breaking news from yesterday. Breaking. You can just wipe your ass with your mask because per my Instagram feed, COVID's over. It's done. We beaten it.
Feels good.
I'd rather not do that because I did not spend the money for comfortable masks. My face is raw enough.
Face. Might as well get an ass to match.
I watched that episode of South Park this week with the Chipotle way. Y'all remember that one?
Yes. I don't think I've ever seen that one.
It's where, God, these shows are so grotesque when you explain the episode, but it's when you eat so much Chipotle that you're shitting blood.
Oh, God.
So they make this spray to get it away. I keep thinking of that every time. Like when you said the Moderna or the Pfizer thing, I thought Moderna, that's the one. You got to get Moderna away.
Wait, when I said what?
When you said the Pfizer.
Oh, it's Pfizer.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I always pronounced it Pfister.
Oh, that's a different thing.
So the mainstream media has gotten it wrong again with its pronunciation.
MSEM, as we call them.
Lame mainstream? Try lamestream.
Exactly. Speaking of which, did you guys get around to watching the My Pillow Guys riveting 3-hour documentary, Mike Lindell?
I haven't stopped.
It's on repeat.
I'm going to be honest with you. Like people tell me things like, you can like learn skills just watch a YouTube video about it. I can't sit still for a minute and a half of something that might actually make my life better. Why do you think I'm going to spend three hours watching this?
This is the My Pillow guy.
Yeah,
he had a tweet that claimed it, that he could prove the election was stolen via his 3-hour documentary, and if it fails to catch on, and that'll be it. That'll be
the rapture.
That's the rapture.
So here's my question for you:
when?
I'm waiting.
Does Mike Lindell hang out with Papa John? Because he's got some big Papa John energy here.
Big PJ energy.
Yeah, big Papa John energy. Like I eat, you know, 3 pizzas a week or whatever, 3 pizzas a day. I don't remember what it is. I'm all red and sweating. a storm is coming to wash away all the filth.
T.D. Wood's going to kill me for this one, but the Undertaker used to have a manager that came out ringside with him, and this is exactly who Mike Lindell is. Looks like, is, I mean, shit. What is this guy's name? He's dead now. He was from Mobile, Alabama. I need to Google this.
This anyway. Is great. That's great.
Oh, yeah. He looks just like him. Google it, people. Google. So it was The Undertaker, and it was Paul Bearer. Yeah, that was it.
That's a good point.
Paul Bearer.
That's great.
I do feel like people who are much smarter and more informed than me have been like, you can understand the Trump presidency via professional wrestling.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah.
Which makes absolute sense to me. Hey, based in Connecticut.
Yeah, if you get really into like gangster films, it's like, oh, this all makes sense.
You know, there was a bit where it's like, oh, Martin Scorsese, so whatever. And it's like, gee, too bad there's not a guy who's been like making films that are a blueprint to help us talk and think about this between, you know, Goodfellas, Wolf of Wall Street, The Irishman. Taxi Driver, like, it's just over and over I return to these.
Yeah, we had a Taxi Driver situation at the beginning of January, didn't we? Almost, I guess.
Situation.
Apparently, it was just Mike Lindell narrating over a PDF about how we should have a civil war.
So. Sounds like when I guest lecture in a class.
I thought we were going to learn about the library today.
Hell no. Yeah. We'll do that at the end. But first.
So credit to Will Sommer, Daily Beast reporter. He tweeted that Lindell claims he's getting 3 hours of sleep per night because he's been working so hard on this and it's starting to show.
These guys who claim about how little sleep they get is the most just bullshit thing. You know, Trump talking about, like, I don't exercise because then I won't have the mental energy to do whatever I need to do.
Yeah, the body's like a battery. You got to save up the energy.
It's like, I don't know that bragging about only getting 4 hours of sleep every night is necessarily the best thing.
No, it's not.
You know who's the opposite of that? LeBron James. He sleeps a bunch. He sleeps through things and misses things. He loves sleeping.
Is that true?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Professional athletes, they sleep all the time. I'll tell you, when I first started really touring, especially in like a vehicle that moves overnight, I kind of got obsessed with reading how the NBA players deal with it because they have to stay up so late and then perform at a high. I mean, if they're leaving the arena at like 1-2 in the morning and then getting on a plane and going to some other city, it's like, how do they do this? Yeah. And then actually physically do a thing. It's pretty fascinating. There's some good articles out there.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by this because how people function on odd schedules is always interesting.
I think LeBron James would be a good hang if you could ever get him on the pod.
He seems like a cool dude.
He actually does. Like, I wouldn't want to compete against him in anything. Like, I don't want to go golfing with him, right? No. Like, I don't want to play checkers against him. None of that. But, like, he seems like he would be fun to talk to.
Remember there was a Hard Knock season with the Texans where they had J.J. Watt as kind of like one of the main characters, you know? Uh-huh. And he was just talking about, like, you know, the cameras are following him. And he said, man, my life is super boring because he's so hyper-focused on the sport. And it was just him, like he had a nap space at the team facility. It's like, I just sleep all the time and work out.
What's his name? Poor Justin Fields, right? Like that one interview they had with him. He's like, yeah, you know, Ohio State seems like it's a really pretty campus. I'd love to see it one of these days.
Amazing.
I wish I was making that up.
I mean, this is why these guys get like DUIs all the time. You know, they don't drink. They go out and have like four drinks and all of a sudden it's not that I'm condoning anybody having four drinks and getting behind the wheel, but there's a bunch of Toucan Sams.
They have absolutely no, no tolerance.
No social lives.
And no body fat, which speaking from experience can really help you out.
Man, we are off the rails.
As I stumble from my, from my living room to my basement.
This is peak performance.
All right, guys, you got, give me a tweet length review of this week's WandaVision.
Natalie nailed it.
Okay. Where? On Twitter?
No, on one of the earlier talks, Natalie was sharing some of her inside knowledge. And are we in spoiler zone yet?
Yeah, if you haven't watched this week's WandaVision, spoiler.
And, you know, she said, well, we're thinking, you know, folks are saying maybe Pietro is going to come back, but it's not going to be, you know, the guy from Age of Ultron, which,
yeah,
you know, the same was. She recast Pietro?
Yep. Evan Peters, I think, is the actor's name from the Fox version of Marvel.
I like that they said, just be the Fonz.
Yeah, exactly.
That was great.
Adam, did you get? I hope you watched. You watched.
Sure. I did. Yeah. No, it's required viewing in this house. We watched Friday night. I thought it was good. I thought it's veering more and more toward the disturbing.
Yeah.
Dealing with weightier issues, and went back to kind of living in universe this week a little bit, which was kind of a nice blend. Last week was kind of a clean break. It's she's a scary character.
I appreciated that Wanda is not straight up the villain, but as Vision points out, like,
Vision's creeped out right now.
She's Dante's Inferno, right? Like, some of the punishments are like, you're just stuck in the slough of despond, right? Forever. And that's hell. Like, she's keeping these people in hell.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. I like that the accent came back when she's outside of the Maximoff anomaly.
Yeah, she came out. I really like that scene, though.
Yeah,
it was coming out to tell them to, you know, leave them alone.
It was scary. When all the lasers from the guns, which I thought was a great
That was a fun little visual.
When they all turned on the commander, who is still kind of iffy in my book.
He's definitely iffy.
Not on the up and up there. But, yeah, that was you know, she's, like I said, disturbed, kind of, but complicated character.
For sure. She's going to be the protagonist and villain, it looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about the first movie we're going to discuss today, which is the new HBO Max documentary called Fake Famous. This documentary follows three people as they try to garner fame through this idea of buying followers, heavy on the Instagram, social media. It's an attempt for them to become influencers. An idea I've always thought was just utterly bizarre. But, you know, that's probably a lot to do with the fact that I'm 44 years old and a dude. But when I first heard of this idea of influencers, I had no idea what it was. And I'm still not sure. Adam, you watched this. And Donovan, I'm curious. Did you get around to it?
I did not get around to this. I have thoughts about this, but I didn't get around to it.
I was going to say that I don't think that this movie is, there's no spoilers that are really involved. It's a documentary. And if you, if you're listening and you wish to skip ahead to the next segment, that might, you might want to, but if you know anything about Instagram, this is not going to be spoiler heavy. So
now explain Instagram to me, Blaine.
You put pictures and people press a heart button. There's a heart button for each picture, and people can press the heart button on it if they like it.
And the heart button is wired directly to your brain.
Yeah, you get this jolt of, it's almost like a little tiny sniff of cocaine. You just get that for a second.
The heart bump.
Will you do absolutely anything to chase that feeling?
Some folks will, yeah.
That's part of what this is about, for sure. It's an examination of that. The guy, the director, Nick Bilton, worked for the New York Times, right?
Yeah, I think he's written for a few different outlets and kind of been like a talking head on call about tech. He wrote for Vanity Fair as well. So this is his arena.
Right. And this to me felt like a excellent explanation of why Black Mirror is scary. You know, because there's this moment where I think it's the director who's also on camera quite a bit. He says that the likes are a currency of our time. And how scary is that?
It is scary. It's, you know, I thought it comes up at the end, not to zoom all the way to the end, but they frame all of this as, I think it was negatively framed. Obviously, he kind of has an agenda with the whole influencer culture and how it's affecting us. And it zooms to the end, and there's a bunch of kids kind of being plotted around by influencer parents, and those are the pictures mm-hmm. that it ends on, and it kind of asks, is this what we want society to morph into for these guys, or is this how we want them to grow up? I thought it was a very well-made documentary. I didn't find myself looking at my phone at all. I was kind of on the edge of my seat. I do think he definitely had conclusions already drawn that he then made the documentary around, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that I think that's very, very true. There is a BuzzFeed article, and the headline claims that the documentary doesn't know what an influencer is, but makes fun of them anyway.
I thought that was a great, that's Stephanie McNeil writing, who is a influencer reporter, a social media reporter. Yeah, I thought, you know, you have that job, and I understand that there's a lot of interesting human stories in any sector, you know, that she's maybe trying to unearth or talk about how things there reflect larger societal trends. And she made a lot of really great points that kind of made me think twice about the documentary, I guess.
Okay, name what they were.
Again, I think his conclusion was already in place before he set out on the journey, so to speak. Part of it, she claims, you know, in trying to kind of have a takedown of the world created by America's Next Top Model or American Idol or any of those kind of things, and then the gasoline with social media, he kind of recreates that. You know, there's a big casting call. He ultimately picks three attractive 20-somethings who are already in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he then sets parameters around like a hierarchy of what is deserving of fame and attention, which is kind of, you know, they all got picked because they're kind of unremarkable. Like anybody who, the athlete, the basketball player, it's like, oh, well, he may actually break somewhere, you know, mm-hmm. and garner some fame. The musicians that tried out, the same thing. So I don't know. I think it felt like taking a hammer to the problem to just buy bots. You know, that was kind of like the crux of his plan. And I think it was NBC News actually had a really good article that said, if anything, this is like a tribute to doing something really well. Like if you have enough money and know-how, that's how you're successful. It doesn't really have anything to do with a specific skill. Does that make sense? Like you can kind of bludgeon your way into success.
Yeah, for sure. And is that how you see it?
Well, I mean, I am more cynical about influencer culture for sure than the BuzzFeed article than Stephanie McNeil would be. I think it's all kind of bullshit. And mm-hmm. I think being in the music industry and hearing, you know, followers count as like currency, again, to yeah. use that word to say like, oh, you know, you will even listen to something and like it. And I mean, I've seen this play out and I've seen myself do it. You look somebody up and you're like, oh, well, they only have like 1,500 followers. You know, like how serious can their operation be? And part of that, it's tough to learn, but part of that is purely business. Like why would if we're talking specifically about music, why would a label want to work with somebody who hasn't already garnered enough attention that they can just kind of plug in and pour a little gasoline on it and get something going? But to me, that's a more material way to understand it. Whereas I think maybe this documentary is tough for me because I fundamentally do not understand the fashion industry.
Yeah, or like me either.
Wellness culture. I don't really understand like wellness culture or say like, you know, some of the people that they show in the BuzzFeed article does a good job pointing this out were people who have come up with either fashion stuff or say like a hair care line or any of these things. They're saying that some of these people are legitimate business people mm-hmm. who just use social media to grow their reach. And they've done it in this way through influencers. So that's a whole world that I don't understand because to me, it's like, what's the point? Dr. Bronner's goes everywhere. I get a haircut on the porch every other week. Every other month. I'm not the target audience here. I understand that, but I don't know. I mean, what was your takeaway on all of that? I feel like I am not in a place to judge either side because I fundamentally do not understand something that's so important to so many people.
It really is. I mean, there's it's I'm going to sound like a verging on boomerism, but again, I am a middle-aged guy, as much as that pains me to admit. This just all feels like bullshit. I have loathed the idea of YouTube star. I don't, to me, there's no more loathsome term than YouTube star or influencer. And I know what an old man I sound like, but to me, it's a whole lot of famous for nothing. Where, and I'm talking about, I guess, specifically influencers, maybe I should underscore that, because I'm not talking about people who have a clothing line and actually make cool stuff, and then they end up with a lot of followers because everybody wants to see what they're making or art or whatever. I'm talking about where there's just no skill set. There's no improvement to the world. There's no art. There's no, they're not offering any kind of special analysis. They're not offering any entertainment. It's just, and he mentions this in the documentary. It's just, my life's better than yours.
Yeah.
I can't stand that.
I think that's a huge part of it. But then, I don't know. I mean, celebrity culture has always been aspirational for Americans, I think. Like, you're the classic thing. As a European sees the house on the hill and says, the American says, one day I'm going to be that guy. And the European says, one day I'm going to get that guy. You know, we look at the world that way. And these people who are living these fabulous lives, that's attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah, I was running things through my mind as this played. And one of them was, yeah, I want the fame, but I want it because I want the money that comes with it so I can pay my bills, so I can get rid of student loans. They seem to just want it as an existential kind of thing. I really thought that the young man Wiley got to it when he was not saying it in these terms, but there's this existential fear behind these people who are, what legacy or am I going to leave? What effect can I have beyond myself? And it's just filling a void in their soul or heart or whatever, which we all have, depending on how big or small the void is. I mean, we all need it filled, but usually we get it from, you know, hopefully we get it from our parents, our wives, our children, husbands, you know.
Yeah, I think that's why this documentary worked for me, is because it was asking those very big questions, even as it was maybe dismissive of things that are valid and important to certain people. You know, I thought of Wiley early on when he's driving and he's holding the two phones, which is always, that cracks me up. It's like, this dude's dealing drugs, right? No, it's
really, yeah.
But you can't, you got two phones, something fishy's going on. I still stand by that.
I do too.
But he's driving around and he says, well, I mean, everybody else wants to be famous, so it must be good. I want to be famous. Mm-hmm. That's what everybody wants.
Yeah, that was it. That was the moment where I felt I connected to a more existence kind of thing. He just wanted to be famous because, and I'm putting words in his mouth and interpreting what he says, he wanted to be famous because he wanted people to know him. It seemed like he wanted, all three of them really kind of sort of wanted to be loved in some way. And I can relate to that. And I totally relate to that. And listen, a lot of this I was also filtering through the notion that I run the Alabama Take, and damn, I wouldn't mind having 35,000 followers. And I kept thinking, why? Why do I want 35,000 followers? What does that lead to, you know?
Yeah. I mean, all of them, well, I remember two of them definitely saying to have a good influence on the world. Dominique seemed to think more about career opportunity. You know, she working to be an actor. But the other two, it seemed to be more of a personality thing, which is, that's such an interesting, I guess that's a thing that you feel more intensely at a young age. It's like, I want to change the world. And then you get older and you're like, I don't know anything. What? How am I going to positively?
Never change? Did.
Yeah. So I don't know. It was an interesting, I think maybe in its quest to do one thing, it opened a lot of other doors, this documentary.
Yeah.
For instance, why the one that's successful is the most pliable individual, But she's also a cute blonde, 20 something. So it's like, what could we learn? And that's something that some of these articles kind of point out. Like there's an interesting documentary in asking the question, why was she so successful compared to the other two? Wiley just kind of peaced out, right? All their reactions were interesting. She did what...
And if you haven't watched, I'll interrupt you briefly, but if you haven't watched and you've listened this far, and you're interested, then right here is there is a little bit of an ending to this story, and we'll probably spoil it here. So,
yeah, the three arcs. Dominique Druckmann is the cute white blonde who ends up becoming kind of Instagram famous, right?
She ends up becoming somewhat of an influencer for sure.
Yeah, and then there's Chris Bailey is the one that we really haven't talked about as much. He had the funniest reaction to me. You know, Wiley kind of got a shot of what it takes to be an influencer and said, no, that's not for me.
Got a little freaked out.
That happens in every industry where you kind of have to put yourself out there. He's like, nah, this, I don't like this. And it's funny that he doesn't like it because he got called out by basically an acquaintance from back home in Georgia, right? Who said, dude, this isn't you. What's going on?
Yeah. And that freaked him out a little bit.
Which I think said a lot about your reaction to a message like that doesn't mean you're a good or bad person, but I thought it said a lot about his character that he internalized that so much.
What do you think it said about him?
That he had the willingness for personal reflection in that moment, even on camera. You know, that's a very vulnerable. He could have just not told anybody about that. And he has these people that are buying him followers, and he's moved to Los Angeles. So there's clearly an aspirational element to him being there, even if he can't really say specifically what he wants to do. He knows, you know, that moment where he's filling up the gas tank and even an extra gas canister. And he said, I've been in LA for a year. If he'd have told me this is what I'd be doing, because he's doing it for his boss. It's like, he didn't even finish the sentence, I don't think, because it's so far off. And it's King of the Hill famously says, life is a series of compromises. And he's getting a big old dose of that. I thought his arc was very interesting. I thought Chris, his was interesting in that he signed up for a project, an experiment, and then just refused to cooperate with it pretty much.
Yeah, it didn't take long and he was out. He was like, he had that telling line that said, would I rather have 100,000 fake bot followers or 100 real ones? And he would take the 100 real ones any day.
Yeah, he is the only one that seemed to be putting in, Dominique was as well. She's going to casting calls and all that, but he wasn't waiting on anybody to give him a chance already. You know, he alludes to the fact that he had stuff going on in his hometown, doing these shows, doing a fashion line, whatever. He's actually doing, and says, I don't need to fake it. I'm going to be, his aspiration is still to be famous, which is interesting to me, but I don't know. I think all of this resonated so much with me, at least being in music and all the different personalities that you get in that world, people who their goal is to be famous. And there's people who are more craft focused, and there's people who, you know, might as well be a plumber. They just happen to be really good at the bass or whatever it is.
I thought about you a lot when I was watching this, about how would you view this as a musician, and how you have to, part of being a musician and being able to put on shows is having followers and pushing yourself and saying things about your music.
Yeah, and you often end up with people. You know, the higher, I guess, level of stuff that I've done, there are just people there who you're like, I don't understand what you do, you know? And they're these kind of people
Can you give me an example?
No.
Without maybe name? No?
No. Without, I mean, sometimes you're hanging and like, you're like, oh, this is a famous musician, that's why this person is here. But there's always, once you get to, I don't know, it's tough to articulate without being mean, but,
well,
you know, there's this whole... People just enjoy, I mean, you could see it on Dom's face when people start sending her free stuff, you know, that rules.
Yeah. Like
being backstage and getting free stuff is awesome. Mm-hmm. And sitting at home and people mailing you, for her, it was jewelry and all these different kinds of hipster kind of wellness packages, all that kind of stuff. And she was enjoying it. And that's, you know, people get a little dose of that and you get all the good feels from people liking on your pictures. It's like, that's a drug for people.
Yeah, it is. It totally is.
I will say that I thought the BuzzFeed article pointed out maybe she's just good at being an influencer. You know, maybe that's part of why it worked. In addition to her kind of being the stereotype for success, you know, cute, white, blonde. Maybe she is kind of, I mean, she was charming in her videos. She did genuinely go viral with the bidet thing, which was funny.
I didn't even know about that, so.
I hadn't seen it, but it was, when they showed it, I was like, oh, that's a funny.
Yeah.
You know, in the middle of the quarantine, that would have made me laugh for sure.
Yeah.
And that maybe that's a certain kind of skill. All of that to say, I think when they showed the bus that she was on.
Yes.
And I thought it was cruel how they lampooned all the women on it, even though they didn't know that they were being judged in that way. And even said about Dominique, oh, this is going to be a great acting challenge for her to like pretend to give a shit about all the things that they care about. That looked like hell on earth.
Yeah, I lost some interest there when they brought in these real, quote unquote, real influence or seasoned influencers. I lost a whole lot of interest at that point. Luckily, it didn't take long before they shifted back to Chris, and that's where we saw him deleting the bot followers, just deleting all their comments and saying how cheesy they were. I was just going to say, I was reminded so much of, I actually know two contestants from The Bachelor. I taught them. Well, I taught one of them. And the other one I knew because I taught, she was in the high school where I taught as well. So I taught two, or knew two. They both came from the same high school. And it's just baffles me how that's, yeah, I see them on Instagram and their follower count and all that is just so bizarre. So Donovan, you didn't watch the movie, but you said you had some thoughts in general. Talk to me. As an influencer yourself.
Mostly what I thought of was how interesting it is to see people who I know in real life who are like influencer adjacent or things like that. Like I know someone like I used to work with. And they were Crimsonette and did all that kind of stuff and like have a day job and everything, but will occasionally be like influencer adjacent with like things on their like fitness things. I know somebody who is Instagram famous, but not from being an influencer, but because she's an artist. She sells her art and illustrates for magazines and things like that. And it's very, but she does have like a presence, you know, that she curates.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's, My thoughts mostly are, you know, if you are the product, I guess. If you're not paying for the product, you are the product. Hmm. Like, there's a winner at the end of this, and it's Instagram and it's Facebook.
Excellent point. Well, the Alabama, as the Alabama take, I guess I should say, the Instagram account, I did go follow Dominique and Wiley. I couldn't find Chris. I was just interested in what they're still doing now that it's a year later after the documentary. Yeah.
Can we just talk about The Bachelor now? I'm fascinated by, in a really facile way, I'm fascinated by the fact that these are real people.
Oh, yeah. And Adam is actually, he graduated from the same high school as these two ladies.
I wondered if it was that high school.
Yeah, that was it. And I taught one of them as a 10th grade, and she was just a child. And now she's out in LA and has, I don't know how many followers, and is, you know, she's kind of in the influencer realm for sure. With I could tell by her Instagram feed.
So did you, kind of background for all this, have you been keeping an eye on how, especially like new agey type Instagram accounts were really infiltrated and infected by like Q stuff and like anti-masker stuff? And it's a really strange, because conspiracy theories usually skew male and kind of new agey stuff usually skews female. And you have, you know, folks that research this sort of thing. If you have the New York Times, you can look up some of Kevin Roos's work on this. But you started to get really interesting intersections of like anti-mass stuff and Q stuff in, under the aegis of self-actualization, you know, this kind of new agey. It's, you know, this influencer stuff is increasingly like weaponized, if that makes any sense. Like you can weaponize it really fairly easily if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, that's not surprising. All right, so the documentary is Fake Famous. It's on HBO Max, and it's interesting. It wasn't necessarily my favorite thing, but it did spur a lot of conversations, obviously, for me. So there you have it. Let's go to our break. Yeah, let's use this break to remind you of a few things. Our coverage of the challenge by head writer T.D. Wood continues on the Alabama Take website. Speaking of influencers, those pieces appear each Thursday, so keep your eye out for those every week. If you want some apparel with our logos, then head over to the site, click on Shop, and you can venture to our Key Public store where you can place your order for T-shirts and a whole lot more. Lastly, follow us on social media. How about that? We do have an announcement coming in the next few weeks you'll want to know about. We teased that at the beginning of today's show. A whole lot more next week on that. We will now get back into our episode of Taking It Down.
You know what CT's name is on Instagram?
Famous for nothing.
That's right. The man gets it.
But he's not famous for anything. I mean, he's a competitor. He's like a sports star to me. So
he's a skilled guy. I agree. Yeah.
To me, that's putting on an entertainment. There's something of value with that. Okay, we're back in that conversation. Anyway.
Let's go to the other end of the spectrum.
Let's do the get in. So it's our goal to talk about the Netflix British drama, The Dig, which was released, I think, at the very end of January on that streaming service. The tagline for the movie explains that on the eve of World War II, a British widow hires a self-taught archaeologist to dig up mysterious formations on her land, leading to a staggering discovery. It stars Carey Mulligan and Ralph Fiennes and is directed by Simon Stone, who seems to be a relative newcomer to movies and writing. Donovan, I toss it to you. What do you think about The Dig?
Longing glances, the movie.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
You know, no, it was very beautiful. But if you want my overview, really liked Ralph Fiennes and Carey Mulligan playing against each other. Mm-hmm. Off of each other. I felt that the movie got super distracted once Ralph Fiennes was not quite as much in the picture when it switched to the Lily James character.
Yes.
Also, it's Sutton. You said pronounce it Sutton Hoo, right? I think it's Sutton Hoo.
Mm-hmm.
The Sutton Hoo ship burial just is in and of itself. Like I found myself watching this movie and being like, wow, this should be really boring. But I'm like kind of into The Dig, right? Like the centerpiece of it is really, I'm interested in this.
Yes.
So there was a lot, I felt like there was a, like that was done very well and a lot of craft and it looks very pretty. And, you know, Sutton Hoo, you've probably, I have my whole various places because it's fairly famous, right? Seen like the Anglo-Saxon helmet from Sutton Hoo, which is one of only three or four in existence. I don't remember exactly. But you know, these are extremely rare treasures. And, you know, he, you know, they kind of allude to it, but things that I think are fascinating, right, is some of the things found in this ship site were from like Eastern Europe or from, I don't remember if it's in this ship or elsewhere, but like the Byzantine Empire, right? You know, just the way that it helps us paint a picture of a Dark Ages world that was truly international. Also, the mounds in the back of my head made me think of Moundville, and I like Moundville.
Oh, so yeah. There's that. And it will. Any Tuscaloosa or Alabama native will immediately think of Moundville when they see this film. So, Adam, give me an overview, but before I get into some of my theories on why they take such a maybe a boring concept and turn it into a fairly riveting movie, what did you think?
On why they made that choice?
No, on your overview of just the movie itself.
I thought it was really good. I did wonder if maybe there was a better movie with slightly different plot focuses at different times. Kind of like y'all were saying, mm-hmm. that there's some characters who have real chemistry with each other I liked the pace. I enjoyed that it was slow. It's funny that we're talking about Fake Famous in the same program because it's just the opposite of that. You know, it's the English countryside is beautiful. Let's have this slow plotting kind of thing. But if it had been cut by 15 minutes, maybe there's a better film with reduction there. But I don't know.
It honestly, part of it felt like, again, with the, like, and Friends, I love Lily James. I love when she shows up in a movie. I think she's great.
She was great.
But I just felt like with that, it was almost like they did the Ralph Fiennes, Carey Mulligan stuff and was like, uh-oh, we don't have enough. We don't have a movie. We don't have enough for a two-hour movie. We got to film 30 more minutes of material. That was very odd to me.
Or even like, uh-oh, we don't have a love story. We've got to have that.
Even though there was strong chemistry between the two leads.
Absolutely. I really loved the way they just played, you know, Ralph Fiennes and Carey Mulligan just played. They had incredible chemistry and you could tell like the class that was separating them, like the class barrier. And I mostly picked up on that more with movements and, you know, like it was very subtle. I thought maybe someone would think they're chewing the scenery, but I thought it was very good, right? Like I loved watching them together.
Agreed. And even his movements physically around the dig were like, this is just a master at work.
Yeah.
You know what I loved? So I just love Ralph Fiennes. Like I love him.
I do too. Yeah.
He's amazing. And I loved how in the dig, like he almost stepped. When he's not in the dig, he seems like he's almost stepping haltingly and carefully, as if he's not quite sure of his body. And then while he's digging, that becomes his asset, right? That care. And I really loved watching. I just think Ralph Fiennes is great. Like I just loved watching him do, and I loved like the accent and everything. Cause I'm the whole time watching it, remembering his like, for years, Lawrence Presents has meant something, right? Like he can just do so much, right? He's such a versatile actor.
He sure is.
Ah, I thought he was great.
This was a movie that did not give a damn for exposition, but it just started. In fact, I paused it about 3 minutes into it and thought, did I start this in the middle? Did this movie start? So, I loved how it handled, and this is part of my theory on why it's so well-paced, is it allowed conversation to continue while it went ahead and began the other scene. So kudos to the editors as well as the composer of the score who lets you know that the pace isn't slow. And they get away from that a little in the middle, which I think hindered it a bit. And that's around the time where, and if this, we probably just need to go ahead and lay down spoilers for our listeners. So if you're thinking of watching this, this will be some plot points you'll probably want to absorb as you watch. But you're right. When they got into the Lily James stuff where she is, I mean, it's totally telegraphed that her husband, Stuart, at the dig is gay. And she plays this lady, Peggy, and she's attracted to the Mr. Lomax character. And that felt like a B plot that was so unnecessary.
It came way too late for me to care.
Right. If this would have been established, I think, earlier, around the same time that the dig started, somehow or another, maybe we could get something from Peggy and Stuart, wherever they were in London, I guess. It just, like, they just appeared and suddenly have a problem. And as an audience member, I didn't care.
Same. I didn't. That's not where I was invested.
No, it was not.
You know, I'm invested with, Edith and Basil. And actually, I kind of wish there'd been a little more of it. I was honestly very struck by the dynamic between Basil and his wife.
Yes, that too.
I wish that had been explored a little more.
But it's funny because I glanced on a message board and the people who watched this movie really loved the Lily James story. It's funny. So I don't know what how I'd label this audience on this message board, but they were all for that part of the story. And they seemed okay with the rest of the movie, but they really were all about Stuart and Peggy's disillusion of their marriage and her running off and humping Mr. Lomax in the last scene.
That's not the way I saw it.
No, yeah, I guess they want a romance, but this was not a romance to me.
And I understand maybe some of the attraction of that story because, you know, there needed to be stakes to the fact that the war is coming.
Right.
You know, and I thought that its slow build in the background was so well handled.
Mm-hmm.
Even with the, say, like the plane going down, was very on the nose. But, you know, I understand they needed characters to be in harm's way, I guess, to like give it stakes. And so introduce a love story. But it felt like how many, we're making a movie in 2020 to come out in 2021. How many issues can we hit in one fell swoop? You know what I mean?
I felt like that B plot, I felt like I was watching another movie. It wasn't a bad movie.
Mm-hmm.
It just not was a different movie. And I totally agree with Adam about the stakes. But I also thought it was, you know, kind of like Adam said, trying to cram too much in, because there were already stakes with, I keep wanting to say Alan Lomax, and of course that's not right, but Lomax, the cousin, right?
Right.
Going into the RAF, and I felt like the stakes there were Edith is sick. You know, she's got what, consumptive heart failure or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
And she's worried that her son will be left alone. Those are good stakes, if you ask me. I can relate to that.
I liked how it used the backdrop of World War II, you know, this Titanic event still to us today, but it served as, at times, a minuscule point to what they're finding in the dig.
There was one part, and this is a part that I actually did like with the Lily James story, where he asks, if 1,000 years passed right now, what would be left of us?
Right. Yes.
And it kind of, which I did, you know, I sound like I'm running down this subplot, but like everyone in it was great. There were moving scenes, like everybody was good. But I felt like they kind of glancingly mentioned too, right? Like this, the war that we're embarking on is huge, right? But it's also kind of in the context of history, you know, in the context of the amount of time you're dealing with here.
Centuries.
Yeah, it you just take a different perspective, you know, and I kind of liked some of the subtle, you know, the things that kind of raise the hair on my neck when I think about it, like the fingerprints in Tutankhamun's tomb, or, you know, it's just amazing when you think about it. And I felt like the movie was actually, maybe not entranced, what's the word, honoring that sense of wonder, I guess.
Yeah, in a more mannered way. Speaking of fake famous, in a more mannered way, this film also examines what we're going to leave behind, and posits how human movement plays into what we're going to leave. I thought that was also kind of intriguing and subtle and well handled. Adam, I do have a question for you specifically. You've worked in film, and what did you make of the use of the lens flares with all the cinematography? Did you have a comment on that?
No, because...
I'm a sucker for that. I love that.
It felt a little Wuthering Heights to me.
It did, but I'm a sucker for it. I think it looks good.
I thought that I thought all of it was great in terms of cinematography. The fact that they really just stayed in a field the whole time. I think it highlighted, you know, you think of World War II, you think of machinery, you think of how fast the world moved immediately afterward. The 20th century, as we understand it, as people who existed in the latter half, are really the tail end of, it became that, you know, and here you have people who have lived very slow lives. I mean, they lived through World War I, so they had seen the mechanization of humanity against itself, but it kind of felt like they were in the Shire, to borrow a Tolkien comparison, and the world was heating up all around them. You know, even when she has to go to London for her doctor's appointment is really the only hustle and bustle that you get. And it's kind of jarring as a viewer because the pace has been so slow and it's been so beautifully shot. And all of a sudden you're in this busier city. Complete side note. I thought the kids playing with the balls that were supposed to be informational. That was a very funny bit.
Throwing them back at that was good.
but a ton of it was about, that worked because it was so much about what Donovan was saying, that here's this massive event, as we still understand it, that's going to happen. How were average humans dealing with it? You know, for that household, her illness was a bigger deal in many ways than the war was, even though, I mean, there's Nazis right across that waterway. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not an abstract concept. But really, some of the highest drama was who's going to have ownership of this dig. That was a big thing. Is it mm-hmm. important to still keep going? So it asked the value of, if you think of those artifacts as, they inform story, right? Mm-hmm. They don't just exist. Their value is not defined. We give them their value because they tell us about ourselves. And it's asking of Ray Fiennes' character, can he swallow his pride and go back on this dig for something that he thinks is bigger than himself? And, you know, it's, they talk about, is he going to get the credit or not? But I don't know. They're such big questions, but they're so subtle, and they come across, especially in the backdrop of a war, as kind of unimportant. But like Donovan said, as the centuries go on, that dig still carrying on is just so massively important at the time.
Yeah, and it plays in such stark contrast to what we were talking about earlier. He did the work because he loved it.
And I do love, you know, at the end. So Beth watched it with me, and at the end, Beth was like, wait, why are they? I think, so they sort of explain that, you know, there's no actual wood there, right? But they didn't really, like, it's turned into sand, and all you can see is the impression. Right. And Beth was kind of like, wait, why are they covering up? You know, like, why are they putting the branches down? She wasn't 100% clear on that, which, fair enough, it could have been clearer. But, I mean, part of it, too, is, like, I love the idea that you're covering it up again, because maybe in 100 years, someone's going to want to look at it again.
Yeah, the loving care that's taken to preserving it, even when you're burying it underground, is, you know, maybe an admission that, you know, even when they were, like, lifting things out, I was thinking that we have to have, archaeology now has to have a better way to do this, a less dangerous right. way for the artist. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's an admission, him covering it up that way, that, you know, humanity is going to go on and figure out a better way to do this. And maybe there's still value here that I can preserve for the future.
And I mean, a cursory glance at, so this is now a National Trust site. You can go take your dog for a walk there, and they've got some, you know, there were other burials there that were discovered later. And a cursory glance says there were more things there. There was more, people learned, which I just find fantastic.
Yeah, it's become one of the most important sites in all of Britain, right? For, like, understanding a certain time period.
And, you know, just, you know, right? Like, the Anglo-Saxons are, right? If you read, like, the Arthur legends, right? They're the bad guys, right? They're the pirates or the... And just to have an understanding, you know, kind of refuting all those who said, you know, when Rome was gone, like, you know, people were just dumb idiots. Right. Didn't know anything. You know, it's like... That is a matter of fact, and kind of I'm always sort of interested in things that kind of put the lie that, like, oh, the people that have lived here have always been the people that lived here, right? Like, XYZ has always been a white nation or whatever, because, like, these people moved around. Mm-hmm. People came from all over. They went different places. You know, people have always moved around.
Did this movie for you guys play like a faster Terrence Malick film?
Yeah. I can see shades of Malick.
Yeah.
Well, like all great British dramas, there was this, I appreciated the sense of melancholy that was just right there, very close to the surface. And of course, like all great British period pieces, there's this classicism that Donovan talked about. So I liked it, other than the B plot felt shoehorned. So that's where I stand with this movie, The Dig.
You know, it was just, that kept it in kind of the B, like, if we're assigning a letter grade, I would put it a B, mostly because the B plot did not destroy my enjoyment of the movie. I mean, I didn't dislike it. I was just kind of, I was just a little less invested.
For sure.
When we didn't have Basil.
Yeah. Okay. So that's The Dig on Netflix. I do recommend it. So that's a wrap for this week. Subscribe to us, rate us, review us, don't miss an episode. And we time step things so you can skip to different segments and you can avoid spoilers. We'll be back next Tuesday with a discussion on the HBO Max release, Judas and the Black Messiah. We're excited to watch that one. We'll also cover probably another thing or two. We will talk to everyone then.